We're just 1 week away from Election Day in Wisconsin, and we at the West Side have been busy bringing you forums featuring all of the candidates running for State Assembly and State Senate in our Western Wisconsin listening area. Today, we continue that tradition with the West Side 23rd State Senate District Candidate Forum. The 23rd District is large. It includes all of Chippewa County, most of Clark County, along with parts of Dunn, Eau Claire, Trempealeau, Barron, Jackson, Marathon, and Wood counties. Some of the cities and towns include Chippewa Falls, Bloomer, Augusta, Greenwood, Owen, Neillsville, Colby, Spencer, and Marshfield. I'm Rich Kramer, and joining me in studio are the two men running to represent the residents of the 23rd State Senate District. Republican incumbent Terry Moulton is a small business owner living in the town of Seymour. He was elected to the State Senate in 2010. Terry Moulton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Good to have you. Phil Swanhorse is the Democratic challenger in the race. He is a small business owner as well and a bus driver for the city of Eau Claire who lives in the town of Lafayette. Phil Swanhorse, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Rich. It's great to be here this morning.
Good to have you as well. And listeners, we'd like you to join the conversation by calling in with your questions and comments for the candidates. The number is 800-228-5615. That number again, 800-228-5615. If you can't get through, you can try our Westside Facebook page. Leave a question there, and we will do our best to get it online. So the basic question, it all boils down to this. Why run for Senate? Terry Moulton, I'll start with you since you're the incumbent. Why run again?
Well, I want to run again because we've accomplished a lot in this last session, last two sessions that I've been in office. We inherited a budget that had a $3 billion hole. We balanced the budget. We actually have a surplus right now. We put more dollars into a rainy day fund, more than in any time in the history of the state. We have about $280 million in that rainy day fund. We reduced income taxes. We reduced property taxes. We streamlined government by reforming much of the regulatory process. We cut spending, and we froze college tuition for our kids to make college more affordable. So I think we've accomplished a lot. We've put the state in the best financial shape that it's been in over a decade, and that's undeniable. That's right from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. So, but there's more things to do. Specifically, I would like to work on some rural broadband issues. Rural schools have some problems that we need to address. Regulatory reform continues to be something that businesses need to have. Transportation is an issue that's coming up. I have a healthcare background, and I want to do some work on comprehensive advanced life support training for rural hospitals. So there's more to do, and I want to continue to keep Wisconsin moving forward.
Very well. And Phil Swanhorse, what is driving you to throw your hat in the ring as for the 23rd State Senate District?
Okay, Rich. I believe the main reason I have decided to pursue this Senate seat is realizing that after 60 years on this planet, I have had a pretty good life, and I got that because of past generations providing a sound foundation for my background. And I want to pass the torch on to the next generation. And I don't think things are quite as rosy as my opponent speaks about. I think there's parts of our society that are hurting, and they're hurting because we're not going in the right direction. One of the things we're not doing properly in the state of Wisconsin is we pay federal taxes, and yet, as a state, we refuse to accept federal funds. The last was the Medicaid money, and that kicked tens of thousands of people off of Badger Care. And it started 4 years ago, actually, when we refused federal rail funds in the amount of $800+ million. I think there's a better way we can run the state of Wisconsin, and it starts by including all of the people, not just those that are business owners, but all of the people, even those who are less fortunate to have what most of us seem to already have.
All right, thank you. It's been a contentious and sometimes divisive 4 years in Wisconsin state politics. By far, the most controversial piece of legislation was Act 10, which greatly restricted what public employee unions could collectively bargain over. But two public employee groups were spared, police and fire personnel. So with a projected budget deficit looming, numbers change depending on who you ask or how you ask the question. Is it time to expand Act 10 to police and fire? And Phil Swanhorst, I'll start with you.
No, I do not believe Act 10 was implemented correctly or properly. The worst part of the implementation of Act 10 is we eliminated the right to talk, the right to negotiate, the right to collectively bargain with one another on what benefits are needed and or what benefits maybe should be cut back. And I am a firm believer that, yes, we cannot repeal and redo all of Act 10, but I would fight vigorously to at least bring back the right to talk with each other, the right to negotiate, the right to collectively bargain so that we can have a fair workplace and understand what benefits and or necessities are needed by the employees so we get a good, strong public sector workforce maintaining the infrastructure of our state.
If I could just follow up on that, yes. Just looking for some more definition on. So you would bring back, you'd like to bring back the collective bargaining portion of what was, or and leave in place the increased contributions, or am I getting that wrong?
I would collectively bargain what we could bring back that was lost by the absolute taking away of retirement and or health care benefits. We wouldn't mandate, the unions wouldn't mandate like Act 10 mandated taking them away. But we would like to discuss if we could get part of it back.
All right. Terry Moulton, public police and fire have been spared from the Act 10 changes. And, you know, we've got some budget stuff coming up. Should it be expanded to police and fire?
Well, let me just say, Rich, about Act 10. We saved the taxpayers of the state, I think it's a figure I heard, is over $3 billion. And we gave the local school district and municipalities some tools to those tools to be able to save that kind of money. But expanding Act 10 to police and fire, that's not a personal priority of mine in the next session. I'm not really hearing talk about doing that. So that's not my priority.
Here's another argument I'd like to play off of what you just mentioned, that the state saved $3.6 billion. I'm hearing a lot of stuff, I'm reading a lot of stuff in the news now. There's like a new kind of counter to that argument. The counter is that it just shifted the cost to public employees, which are also taxpayers. So any response to that?
Well, I hear the argument that what we did was hurtful to the middle class. Well, if you think that government employees are the only, you know, part of middle class, I just don't find that to be true. The middle class is comprised of much more than just government employees.
All right. Let's go to the phones. We've got our first caller of the morning on, and Carolyn in Chippewa Falls. Carolyn. That's a tongue twister for some reason. Carolyn, you're on the air. Thanks so much for calling in. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. My question is in respect to redistricting.
Uh-huh.
And I would ask why Senator Moulton chose to sign the document in May of 2011 where he agreed not to discuss with his constituents the process of this redistricting.
All right, Carolyn, thanks so much. Terry Moulton, first to Carolyn's question, and then I've got a follow-up.
Yeah, there was already a lawsuit filed, and so we could not discuss that stuff. So it was not possible to discuss that because of the lawsuit that was filed.
Gotcha. Question, there's been resolutions, county referendums, to submit a resolution calling for nonpartisan redistricting. Like it's done in, Iowa or something like that. Do you think that would work here? Would you like to support that?
Well, I've read studies on redistricting, and actually if you look at across the nation, states that have gone to a nonpartisan board doing the redistricting have less competitive races than we have that the states that have the elected officials doing it. I think it needs to remain in the hands of elected officials. If you look at Iowa, The competitive races in Iowa districts are pretty similar to exactly what we have in Wisconsin.
All right. Phil Swanhorst, your thoughts on the way the state redistricts voting lines?
I definitely and respectfully disagree with my opponent. I think bipartisanship is the way to go with redistricting. The Iowa example is a good example of how we could be more fair in drawing our lines. And I think, seriously, if you look at our congressional lines, I won't get into our legislative lines, but our congressional lines are a hodgepodge. It just doesn't make sense the way we draw our lines and can cut out blocks within a city from one district to another.
Our next caller is from Eau Claire, and this is Tim. Tim is on the line. Tim, thanks so much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Pretty straightforward two questions for the people that you have on.
Okay.
What is your personal experience with marijuana in terms of usage or non-usage? And what are your thoughts on the legalization of marijuana in the state of Wisconsin?
All right. Let's start with Phil Swanhorst.
Good question. Thanks for the question. Personally, I have never experimented with it. Sorry to blow the opportunity to make a wide confession, but I have not. As far as the use of marijuana, that question has come up. I believe Colorado and another state have legalized the recreational use of marijuana. I do not approve of that. And let me explain just briefly why I do not approve of the recreational use. It's because so many laws would have to be redefined, such as, what is DUI? DUI, driving under the influence, we assume is alcohol. Would we have to rewrite that law to include marijuana? You know, so many obstacles would be there for the recreational use. When it comes to the medical use of marijuana, because of some of the wars we've had in the past and are currently involved with, we have veterans coming back that have stressful ailments. And if a medical professional, a doctor, would prescribe the use of marijuana as one method of helping cure that particular type of ailment, I would be in favor of allowing that with the strict medical involvement.
All right. Terry Moulton.
I have never personally used marijuana. I'm opposed to legalizing marijuana. I think it's a gateway to other drugs that could cause serious problems. I just think that there are other alternatives.
How about for medical use?
I'm opposed to that also.
All right. Tim, great question. Thanks. And for what it's worth, I believe the way the state law is written right now, technically you could get a DWI if you have marijuana in your system. But let's go to the next subject, and I've got a question all lined up, but Willem in Colfax is on the line, and he has the same question on his mind, I believe. Willem, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, I have a question about sand mining. In 2011, there were 22 sand mines in the state of Wisconsin. Now, this many years later, there are 145 proposed or operating sand mines and processing facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the industry says that they need 95 billion tons of sand this coming year. And what I'm concerned about is there have been numerous violations, both of high-capacity wells, unlined wastewater pits, discharges into creeks and rivers. In 18 Mile Creek in Colfax, there was a discharge. There was a farmer whose land is adjacent to a mine who has a half an inch of this colloidal clay covering his property.
All right.
And there have been many other claims, and I'll give you one other example. In the village of New Auburn, there are three or four of these facilities within a half a mile of the school, and the school is downwind of these facilities. The DNR's current regulation is that they allow 10 tons of fugitive dust per year. So basically we're using these children because of silicosis and the harm of breathing silica dust. We're exposing these children to that, and we're using them as a sentinel species to see, you know, because there's no regulation and there's no effort by the Republican Party or instructing the DNR to do a strategic inspection of
All right, Will.
A report. Anyway, my point is that Mr. Moulton makes a lot about future generations, but what kind of future are these children going to have if we turn western Wisconsin into a strip mining area with all these mines? And historically, strip mining areas have low poverty rates. People move out of the areas. It's not an attractive thing for tourism. And I feel like Terry Moulton, I've attended a lot of meetings with DNR and other people. Never have I seen any of our representatives at any of these meetings. They're just they're absent on this issue.
All right.
So I think they're really dropping the ball. And we have the public trust doctrine, which is also being ignored.
Willem, let me get a response from the candidates. Terry Moulton, there's a lot of people concerned about industrial sand mining, and I've heard at a lot of these meetings, you know, where the sand company is making their proposals, that the companies feel like lawmakers, specifically Republicans, seem to be more in favor of business than concerned about the health impacts.
Well, that's absolutely false. We're concerned about people's health and safety also. We have appointed, we have given the DNR two more positions to monitor sand mines. And as far as the entire countryside of western Wisconsin turning into one big sand mine pit, that is not going to happen. And if you look at the number of mines that have been added in the last 3 or 4 years, it's really slowed down considerably. But it has been an economic boon. We will soon become energy independent because of the sand that is being used to get oil and natural gas. So as long as it's done in an environmentally friendly way, and we do support it, but we have to make sure that the environment and health and safety is protected, and we are trying to do that.
Phil Swanhorse, your thoughts just generally on industrial sand mining. Do you think the state's handling it correctly as we sit now?
Actually, I do have a different perspective on how sand mining should be dealt with, and it has to do with one word called decentralization. Madison is controlling how sand mining is progressing all across western Wisconsin, from Viroqua to north of Rice Lake. I think the communities where the sand mines occur should have the authority of how they should be regulated, not somebody 100-plus miles away in Madison. And when it comes to monitoring water discharges and or air quality for the silica, two inspectors are not near enough. I have been told there is a dozen plus inspectors needed from the DNR to the EPA to monitor the amount of activity that's going on. And I don't think it's the responsibility of all taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin to provide those inspectors. Let me further state that I think the mines are doing a profitable business, and they should be the ones responsible for providing the proper inspection so we are providing a good, healthy environment as these mines would possibly progress with local control.
Rich, if I could just make a comment. I was one of the senators in my caucus that opposed the sand mining bills that were proposed in the last session, because it did take away local control from the local towns and counties, and I opposed that. And because of my opposition, that those bills were defeated.
Let me follow up on that. There are some concerns that the next attempt, and you know, the people that are concerned about industrial sand mining and maybe generally opposed to it, absolutely feel that another bill will be coming. But they're worried that it'll be put in the budget. And if it is put in the budget, would you vote against the budget in that case?
I would strongly urge that be removed from the budget, and probably would not vote for a budget that included taking away local control on the sand mining issue.
Okay. And Phil, it sounded like you were kind of making that point already, but if another bill was brought into the state legislature to take away some of that local control, you would oppose it, I imagine.
Absolutely. I agree with my opponent, Terry Moulton, that yes, that should not be part of the budget bill.
All right. The Confluence Project is a big issue within the city of Eau Claire, but also in the region. People are following the news about it. Supporters of the Confluence Performing Arts Center in Eau Claire are asking the state for $25 million through a non-state agency grant. Should tax dollars be used to support the Confluence? Phil Swanhurst, start with you.
Thanks for the good question. It's an important activity to grow the centers of our local cities, especially a good-sized one like Eau Claire. And the Confluence Project is a great example of that. Should taxpayers help initiate the growth of that project? Yes, they should. The biggest benefit I see going forward with this Confluence Project is the collaboration that has occurred between the city and the county, between the university and the legislature. This is the type of activity we need to do. Now, as it progresses down the road, I believe the Confluence Project can be more and more self-sustaining, and tax dollars won't need to be provided to keep it going forward.
All right. Terry Moulton.
Well, I've expressed publicly several times I support the Confluence Project as long as it meets state guidelines and it's not going to be an overburden on the taxpayers. By overburden, I'm hoping that it will be somebody can show me how it will be self-sustaining. But I have worked with developers, the university personnel, setting up meetings with DOA, Department of Administration, on this issue, and will continue to work on this issue. I sit on the Building Commission, and we'll be reviewing it in my position there.
Well, if it's through a non-state agency grant, the Building Commission doesn't have any say.
Oh, absolutely does.
Oh,
yeah, it still goes through the process of in the Building Commission. Yes.
Okay, and again, before the full Joint Finance Committee
and the full legislature.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, let's take our first break. This is the 23rd State Senate District Candidate Forum. The candidates are Terry Moulton. He's the Republican incumbent from the town of Seymour, and Democratic challenger Phil Swanhurst is with us as well. He's from the town of Lafayette. If you've got a question or a comment, you can call in. 800-228-5615 is the number. You can also post a question or a comment on Facebook. We'll be right back. We've got two callers on the line, Tara and Brian. Stay put. We'll be right with you. This is the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to the West Side 23rd State Senate District Candidate Forum. I'm joined by both candidates running for the seat. The 23rd State Senate District includes all of Chippewa County, most of Clark County, and parts of Dunn, Eau Claire, Trempealeau, Barron, Jackson, Marathon, and Wood counties. The candidates are Phil Swanhurst, he's the Democratic challenger from the town of Lafayette, and Terry Moulton is the Republican incumbent elected in 2008. He's from the town of Seymour. The number to call in, 800-228-5615. We've got open phone lines. Right now, we're going to go to Tara in Eau Claire. Tara, you're on the air. Thanks so much for calling in. What's your question?
Good morning. There are a lot of issues being talked about right now during this election time, but to some, not all of them might not seem all that pressing. What I'd like to know is which issue or each candidate, what do they think is the most pressing issue right now?
Great question. Love it. All right, Terry Moulton, for you, what's the most pressing issue in this race?
I think the most pressing issue is growing the economy and putting our friends and neighbors back to work. So I would say jobs, taxes, and the regulatory climate are, but growing the economy is the most important issue, I think.
Phil Swanhurst, how about you?
Well, to grow the economy, the most important element we need to have is a good, sound public education. And I think we're going in the wrong direction with tax money not going to public education, but beginning to be funneled away from that towards private, for-profit, voucher-type schools. So I think education is a very important issue that has to be addressed and make sure we're putting tax dollars to work for all students in public education.
All right. You already answered one of my questions about this, but I'll follow up on that. Do you think we need the voucher program in the 23rd State Senate District?
Well, again, I don't want to be repetitive. No, I do not.
Okay. Terry Moulton, the issue of school choice has come up in the news just recently. The program is aimed at giving parents of students in failing public schools the option to enroll them in a private school for a better education. Recent reports show that the overwhelming majority of the students that are using the state's voucher program were already enrolled in private schools. Is that the goal of the program?
Do you mean the overwhelming majority that were added, or are you talking about overall?
Because
that's a different.
Okay. Well, it was a DPI report that showed about 70% of students. I'm not sure the time frame that are using the vouchers were already enrolled in a private school.
Possibly with the expansion. But, you know, DPI is the one that set the rules on that. That was not the original intent of the legislature on the expanded portion of school choice. So,
all right. And if I could, you know, kind of follow up with the question that I asked Phil, do we need the voucher program? Do we need that opportunity for parents in the 23rd Senate District?
That expansion did cover, you know, there's some voucher students in Eau Claire and in Chippewa Falls.
Oh.
It's already here. For those low-income families.
All right.
That was part of the expansion last time, but it was capped statewide.
Mm-hmm.
And expanding the school choice beyond that is not a priority for me in this next session.
Okay. Let's go to the phones again and a question. You listeners are asking all the questions that I had written down, so I appreciate it, but I'm also a little jealous. I don't know why. But Brian in Fall Creek, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in. What's your question?
Hey, good morning. Thank you. My question is for Mr. Swanhorst. I recently participated in a forum about the minimum wage, and I had three questions that I believe proponents of raising the minimum wage, as he does, need to answer. One, why $10.10? Why not $30, for instance? Two, why do they believe that this is the one unit of production that should be fiat determined its value by government? I mean, why not paper and rent and any other aspect of production that goes into producing the goods and services that we all use and buy? And then thirdly, why does he believe that a dollar spent by a minimum wage employee is better being spent in the economy than that same dollar being spent by the employer? Again, money, we're talking about money that's not currently sitting in a mattress. Any money that would be given to a minimum wage employee is already doing good in the economy. Why does Mr. Swanhorst, who I know is a union representative, why does he believe that a minimum wage employee who's going to buy more hamburgers or whatever, that dollar is more beneficial to the economy than being spent by a person who is, by definition, a job creator because they have minimum wage employees? So those are the three questions I think he needs to answer as to why he supports a raise in minimum wage.
All right, Brian, thanks so much. I'll put that question to both candidates. But, Phil, let's start with you. Phil Swanhorst, let's start with why 10-10. We're seeing numbers somewhere, some are 15 in some states. Some people are calling for 9 and whatever. It's different from state to state. Why 10-10? I'm not sure if you've made the statement that it should be 10-10 or not. But
well, I appreciate the opportunity to answer this question again. Number one, I will not run my campaign by setting an absolute dollar value on what the minimum wage should be.
Okay.
My philosophy is the minimum wage should be raised so that a person working 40 hours a week at minimum wage does not live in poverty. That being said, the reason I believe in that, it not only helps the person not live in poverty, but that person who isn't getting enough money to sustain his family gets government subsidies because of that low minimum wage. We are affecting all taxpayers when we don't pay a livable wage. What should the livable wage be? That's something legislators go to Madison to decide, and it should be decided by labor and business. There's many different aspects, different layers of how a minimum wage should be adjusted. But I will not have a campaign where I draw a line in the sand and say this is the value and I will never budge for it and then go to Madison and can't budge from it and can't negotiate, can't legislate. We have to be able to go to Madison and talk with each other. That's why there's so much gridlock. We make campaign promises that we can't keep. My bottom line is a livable minimum wage where a person isn't living in poverty.
All right, Terry Moulton, your thoughts on the idea of bringing minimum wage up to 10-10 or any number above right now, it's at 7.25.
Well, while minimum wage is a well-meaning attempt to help, you know, certain workers, economic studies have shown over and over again somebody has to pay for that increase. And unfortunately, what happens is the least skilled and the least fortunate among us are the ones that are going to pay for it. A large number of academic studies have shown that minimum wage has done nothing to reduce poverty levels. And the current proposal, a lot of people don't realize, the current proposal of 1010 would cost up to 16,000 Wisconsin jobs, and who knows how many businesses would have to go out of business because of it. The Congressional Budget Office has shown that nationwide we could lose up to 500,000 jobs. So I think we ought to be concentrating more as policymakers on policies that grow the economy and help all workers increase their wages rather than short-sighted policies that might only hurt the people that we're trying to help the most.
We've heard that a lot from the governor on the campaign trail, talking about how he would like to see more jobs that pay 2-3 times that. Let me follow up, though. I did some math, and I'm very bad at math, so take this worth a grain of salt. But $7.25 per hour, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, that works out to about $15,000 per year for a full-time person on minimum wage. Is that enough for an individual or a family?
Well, I would just point out that the percentage, the idea that there are a lot of people on minimum wage that are supporting a family and it's a full-time job is largely untrue. You know, the amount of people that are actually earning minimum wage is a very small figure. And out of that number of employees, it's only about 4% are actually full-time. And other studies show that the vast majority of people who are on minimum wage move above that rate within 1 year. So I think it's a solution that's looking for a problem that really isn't out there.
All right. Phil Swanhorst, $15,000 a year. By the numbers, also taking into consideration what Terry has just mentioned, is that enough?
No, it is not. And you mentioned at the beginning of the show that my occupation is a bus driver for the city of Eau Claire. For 13 years, people have gotten on and off that bus making minimum wage. And if they're the 4% that Terry refers to as we don't have to worry about them, well, I don't feel that way. I see them with my eyes every day, every week, every month, year after year, and I care about those 4%. And we need to address a minimum wage that is a livable wage. Does that mean every single individual at every single job at every single age needs to make the minimum wage? I'm not saying that. I'm saying I'm not drawing a line in the sand. Let's go to Madison and pass legislation that we can come together with bipartisanship and create a livable wage, including for those 4%.
This is the 23rd State Senate District Candidate Forum on the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'm joined by the Democratic candidates. Democratic challenger Phil Swanhorst of the town of Lafayette, Republican incumbent Terry Moulton of the town of Seymour. He was elected in 2010. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, 800-228-5615 is the number. We'll be right back. I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to the West Side 23rd State Senate District Candidate Forum on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this morning. We have the candidates that are running for the 23rd State Senate District in the studio with us. The 23rd includes all of Chippewa County, most of Clark County, along with parts of Dunn, Eau Claire, Trempealeau, Barron, Jackson, Marathon, and Wood counties. Some of the cities: Chippewa Falls, Bloomer, Augusta, Greenwood, Neillsville, Marshfield. 800-228-5615 is the number to call. The candidates are Republican incumbent Terry Moulton of the town of Seymour and Democratic challenger Phil Swanhorst of the town of Lafayette. 800-228-5615. One of the things that has drawn a lot of discussion, a lot of ire, especially among folks on the left side of the aisle, has been Governor Walker's call to drug test certain people who are getting benefits like food share, which is the state's food stamp program, and also unemployment insurance. And I'll start with Terry Moulton, and do you support this idea?
Well, I've been asked that question before, and you know, if people are going to be getting government assistance and taxpayers are footing the bill for that. Why wouldn't you at least do something that would make sure that that money wasn't going for drug use and that type of thing? The problem that we have here is, let's say we've got a single mom and she's got three kids and she is abusing drugs and we find that out. Do we cut off monies that would be going to those children? How do we resolve that? Now, maybe we say, okay, you're going to have to go and get some treatment for the problem that you have. But all of those details in that kind of a proposal are going to have to be worked out before we can straighten it. But I agree with the concept that the devil's in the details of how we would actually make that work.
I've also heard some people say that this would be astronomically expensive. Do you have any concerns about costs here?
Well, absolutely. We'd have to that would be the details
one
we'd
of the
have to look
at the cat.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Phil Swanhorst, your thoughts on drug testing for certain benefits for certain people?
I believe there's already enough qualifications required to receive government assistance that we do not have to add the additional cost of drug testing.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. And in Eau Claire, we've got Joan on the line. Joan, thank you so much for calling. What's your question?
Good morning. In 2011, this Republican administration pushed through legislation that cut $1.6 billion from our Wisconsin public education system. That's K-12, UW system, and Tech College system. Slashing $1.6 billion from public education helps no one. I realize that you already touched on the topic of the voucher schools, but we're currently using citizens' tax dollars to pay for the wealthy to send their children to private schools, and this is simply not right. Public education is many citizens' only chance for a middle-class lifestyle. Now, those of us who currently live in Wisconsin may choose to stay here, but with $1.6 billion in cuts to public education, which those effects aren't fully realized at this time, and may not be for several years, with $1.6 billion cuts in education, who would want to move to Wisconsin? Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Joan, for the question. Phil Swanhorst, any thoughts on Joan's statement and or question?
Well, I don't fully understand her question or statement. I agree with 100%, and let me just add on to it that, yes, that occurred 3 years ago, $1.6 billion, and now this administration has turned around and said, well, we're giving $100 million to education. Well, that doesn't come close to replacing what we took away 3 years ago.
Terry Moulton, your thoughts on Joan's statement?
Well, let me just point out, you know, Wisconsin's got some of the best public schools in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Our graduation rates are second in the nation. We're second in ACT scores. But you have to look at also the cuts that we made to public education were in line with national trends during that economic period. And the difference between what we did in the state versus some of the other states, we gave the school districts tools to use to make up for some of those cuts. And so if you look at trends, like I say, the trend was similar to national averages. The public schools are doing fine. In this last budget, we increased funding by $322 million for K-12 education.
I'd like to follow up with just kind of a general question about how the state funding formula for schools works. The state funding formula, you know, property-based kind of equalized value situation, is that fair for rural school districts? Terry Moulton, I'll start with you, and then we'll go to Phil.
Well, there is a problem with some of the rural school districts who have
vacation
low income and high, you know, high property values.
Mm-hmm.
So the funding formula may be able to be tweaked. That's something we could look at.
Just for specifics, I think the Tony Evers came out with a plan. I don't know the plan off the top of my head, but instead of one of the suggestions, I thought was going from the equalized value situation with property values to like a per student kind of a funding.
Yeah, the problem with Tony's plan is the cost. It has a huge cost to it, so
okay.
We would have to analyze that.
Phil Swanhorst, do you think that the state's funding formula, the way it is now, works for rural school districts? And if not, any ideas to how to change it?
Again, I'm going to use a word I used a few moments ago, and that's decentralization. I don't think one formula works for rural school districts in northern Wisconsin as it does for inner city Milwaukee. We need to give taxing levels and the right to how much we want to fund schools, be they rural or municipal, to the localities that those schools are in, and take the limits away that are established by Madison.
On the same subject of education, public K-12 education anyway, Common Core has been a kind of a contentious issue recently. Governor Walker called on the state legislature to reject the standardized education model developed by educators and administrators, known as Common Core, saying that Wisconsin should develop its own standards. And I'll go from Phil to Terry, but Phil Swanhorst, keep Common Core or change it?
Because Common Core was established very bipartisanshiply. I believe we have not given it enough time. It takes year after year to measure the difference and improvements that could be made with the measurements using Common Core. And we haven't given that program enough time to truly understand how effective it is in establishing those measurements. So I would continue for a while. Does that mean it never should be altered or tweaked or improved upon? No, let's look at it down the road. But for now, let's keep it in place.
Terry Moulton, your thoughts on Common Core?
Well, obviously, there's some problems with Common Core because you're seeing a grassroots movement across the country. Many states are looking at it. What exactly are those problems? I think there's a lot of confusion out there about what Common Core actually requires and potential curriculum, you know, what that curriculum includes. I think maybe the DPI went too fast, that there should have been a little bit more community involvement in the process. If you look at the last session, a bill that was introduced actually still allowed local school districts to make the decision whether they could keep Common Core or not. And I think it should be up to the local school district. But I don't think there's I think more has to be studied on really what is involved in Common Core. So the way it is now, the local school district still has the option of continuing on with Common Core.
So you've got questions about it, but you're not one way or the other on it.
I have told people I don't have enough information to tell whether I can support it or not support it, and that's kind of where I'm at right now.
All right. Mark in Eau Claire, a lot of Eau Claire colors today. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks so much for calling in. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Polls show that most of the important issues for voters remains jobs.
Mm-hmm.
How would your policies help create jobs and grow our economy?
All right, very good. Thanks so much, Mark. Terry Moulton will stay with you, and you've already mentioned a little bit about it, but some specific policies that have been working or you think could be improved upon.
Well, if you look at what's happened in agriculture, for example, our tax credits that were given to the ag industry have really helped the ag industry. The latest reports are agriculture in Wisconsin generates $88 billion now in economic activity. Now, compare that with 5 years ago, it's $29 billion more than it was then. So the ag community has been helped. Tax credits that we've given to manufacturing has also helped. What we've done and what you need to do to increase and grow the economy is to provide a proper tax climate, a proper regulatory climate, and a workforce. We've invested $100 million in workforce training programs. We've streamlined a lot of regulations. I sit on the Small Business Regulatory Review Board. That gives us an opportunity to review administrative rules from the bureaucracies that have an effect, economic effect on small businesses. So taxes, regulatory reform, and workforce training.
Some people some folks that are critical of the idea of regulatory reform would equate that to less regulation.
No, there's a lot of regulations that are duplicative or onerous, mm-hmm, to the point where is creating too much paperwork and too much cost. A perfect example would be a bill that I worked on last session, which I was very proud to get accomplished, Uniform Commercial Building Code. The problem we had in the past was builders, architects, people that were going to, you know, have projects within certain communities. Every community had a little bit different ordinance. We streamlined that. We got a compromise on it. And now we have a Uniform Commercial Building Code, so it will reduce the cost of building projects throughout the state.
All right, Phil Swanhorst, the caller wanted to know what specific policies you have or would like to see implemented to help with job creation, help drive down the unemployment rate further yet.
Okay, I kind of agree with Terry's regulatory reforms, but I don't think we need to eliminate any regulations. Unfortunately, as society grows, there's always someone trying to get something for nothing. And those regulations are there because someone was trying to do just that. And I'm going to put myself on the line and say, I think our taxes in the state of Wisconsin are good at attracting businesses or keeping the businesses here that we have. I think it's a little ridiculous that not for the past few years, but for the past few decades, campaigns are run with the philosophy that we can continue to cut taxes. We cannot continue to cut taxes and maintain the services we expect government to do. The way we attract new business or maintain and keep the businesses we have so our job base is good is to provide the other elements that companies are looking for. By that is a good educational system, a good recreational system, a good environment. These are all things we have here in Wisconsin, and let's keep them, especially a good, sound, basic foundation of a public education.
All right. Back to the phones again. Jack in Eau Claire, education funding, he is on his mind. What's your question, Jack?
Yeah, this is a question for Mr. Moulton. Why don't you just be honest and admit that you're anti-public school and anti-teachers and anti-unions and anti-workers?
Thanks so much, Jack. Terry Moulton, would you like to respond?
Well, that's blatantly false. I believe strongly in public education. We have, like I said before, some of the best public schools in the entire country, so I strongly support them.
I'd like to talk about the transportation budget for a second. Last year, a special committee was established by the state legislature to kind of look at the state's spiraling transportation fund deficit. That committee gave suggestions on for how to come up with around $650 million, what they thought was needed to plug the hole. That included some things like raising the gas tax or going to per-mile fees for drivers in the state, etc. But in the end, none of the suggestions were taken, and the state borrowed more than $1 billion for the roads. So, Terry Moulton, I'll start with you, and we'll go to Phil. What needs to be done?
Sure. I've said this many times. It's going to take a strong bipartisan effort to solve the transportation funding issue. Now, one of the things that was a positive step was the last two sessions we passed a bill for a constitutional amendment, which will go to the voters on November 4th, mm-hmm. to prevent the raiding of that fund, which has happened in the past. And those dollars that were taxed and meant to go to the transportation fund should continue to go there. So I would hope that people would vote in favor of that. But it's going to take a strong bipartisan effort. The Transportation Committee, as you indicated, came up with probably a half a dozen different proposals, gas tax, tolling, registration fees. It's probably going to take a mix of those things. I don't know if one thing is going to solve it. A recent poll showed that people were opposed to a gas tax increase.
Yeah. Nobody wants to pay for
anything. Yeah, that's the problem we have. Everyone recognizes we got a problem, but nobody wants to pay for it. My first step is going to be to find out what we can agree on. And I want to work with people on the other side of the aisle, because the problem is, and why I said it's going to take a bipartisan effort, is as soon as somebody wants to raise a fee or a tax increase, the other side is going to say, oh, wait a minute. So I want to work with the other side, find out what we can actually agree on to start with, and work from there.
All right. That seems like a pretty safe answer. A mix of the things, none of those ideas that were brought up seem more attractive than others?
Well, if you look at gas tax, mm-hmm. that's a fairly fair, because everybody who sure. buys fuel to use, gets charged. Tolling there's an advantage to tolling in that people from out of the state will be able to, help pay for the roads. They're
sure.
using them.
Sure.
There's pros and cons to all of those. And
and Governor Walker recently talked about perhaps some kind of a sales tax, I thought.
Yeah, and I think that might be on auto-related parts.
I'm not sure.
That would then be put in the transportation fund.
Okay. Phil Swanhorst, your thoughts on, we've got $650 million hole in the transportation fund. Some ideas have been put out there, but politicians on both sides are a little leery of increasing fees on people because that makes people angry. What can be done?
Well, first, I want to take 15 seconds. Being a public sector bus driver, I want people to understand that when we talk about transportation, it's more than asphalt and concrete. It includes buses. It includes trains, ferries, airplanes, bike paths, walking trails. So there's a lot to transportation. As far as funding, I'm going to kind of go with Terry's line. It's a bipartisan solution that we need to find. One thing we could do, and it's something we did about 10-plus years ago, we got rid of that gas tax indexing. We should bring that back. That was a campaign ploy. We're done with campaign ploys. Let's get real. Let's work together, and let's get better at collecting taxes.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. That's our time. I'd like to thank the candidates for their discussion. Terry Moulton is the Republican incumbent for the 23rd State Senate District race, and Phil Swanhorst is the Democratic challenger. Thank you both very much. Best of luck on election day to both of you. I'd also like to thank Team Westside, including Mort Cypress, Henry Lippold, Lauren Segrin, and Dean Kallenbeck. If you missed part of the program or would like to listen again, check out our online archives. Go to WPR.org, check out the show's link, click on the Westside, and you'll have years worth of programming to listen to. Next week, we feature the candidates running for the 93rd State Assembly District. They'll be joined by Republican incumbent Warren Petrick and Democratic challenger Jeff Smith. Until then, have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning.